From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we talk about what it means to love your country.
If you have someone who has spent most of their life here working and has raised a family here, if you asked any of their neighbors, is this person American, I think they would likely say yes.
We meet a journalist who traveled from border to border to investigate how Americans feel about immigration. And
Dolores was very gracious when I told her I had stolen her slogan, si se puede, yes we can.
An interview with one woman who has spent her life trying to make the U.S. a better place, Dolores Huerta. Plus, Cuban blogger Yoani Sanchez fights for free speech with limited bandwidth. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week, we're celebrating love of country. But of course, we're not just talking about the 4th of July. A thrilling World Cup is on as well, and everyone in our office has been enjoying cheering on their country, whichever it is. But often, the most patriotic citizens are also the ones who are the most critical. People like Yoani Sanchez. Sanchez is a computer scientist, writer, activist, and blogger who has stirred up a lot of controversy in her home country of Cuba. In 2007, she started a blog, which is no small feat in a place where an hour of time spent online can cost as much as 2 weeks' pay. Her blog, called Generación Y, or Generation Y, focuses on the Cuban government's limits on free speech, its inability to create proper technological infrastructure, and its deliberate control over information. Recently, I met Yoani Sanchez in Chicago, where we talked about her issues with Cuban policies, the development of her now infamous blog, and the steps her country must take in order for it to become the Cuba she was always promised.
Help us to understand what the position should be for many people in the United States who don't quite see the right political angle. They might have believed at some point in some of the values of the revolution, healthcare, education, you know, equality. But they worry that if they criticize Cuba, that somehow they're going to be seen as something that they may not feel that they are, conservative, right wing, et cetera, et cetera. So what do you say to people who are trying to manage how they should approach Cuba at this particular moment in time and approach you?
First, I want to say that I'm completely against those types of classifications that have been established in the universal image of what Cuba is. Pro-Fidel Cubans versus the refugees who were labeled worms after they fled. That labeling is the core of Castro's Cuba. It has been the official propaganda that has divided the country, labeling some with glorious epithets and others with dismissive epithets. That shouldn't be the case, because you'd assume that in any nation, you can have whatever political beliefs you want. So to be accused of being unpatriotic is for them to take away your nationality and push you toward exile. They unnationalize you. So I'm not going to accept the categories of the Castro regime. I have to tell you that every citizen has the duty to criticize, because only criticism makes a society better. So here's what happens. In Cuba, there are a lot of myths and stereotypes that have been exported. For example, education. When someone complains in Cuba about the lack of liberty and the lack of a free press or about the censorship of information, they're told essentially, shut up, because in the end, you've been educated by that same system for free. The Cuban education system that the world likes to talk about, it was a system that existed in the years of Soviet support, where the Cuban government would construct small schools everywhere to have a matriculation of students and a small group of teachers financed by the Kremlin. Imagine a sickly man who is hungry, but who has a buff Arnold Schwarzenegger arm. It's totally disproportionate. That's how the education system was in Cuba. It was a showcase that was financed with Russian rubles. When that funding was cut, the showcase ended, and the education system in Cuba fell into an abysmal state, which is what we live in now. Classrooms with little infrastructure, a lack of proper textbooks, fierce political indoctrination, and an intense imposition of ideology that's been here since the beginning of that education system. Teachers are underpaid. A Cuban teacher makes less than $20 a month. At the most, they make $30. And so that has caused a mass exodus of teachers to other professions, including prostitution. Kids who from 8 a.m. to midday are in front of a television getting teleclasses because there aren't enough teachers to go around. If there is a teaching infrastructure across the country, that infrastructure is in a great deal of deterioration, both ethically and in terms of labor force.
How did you understand that blogging was what you needed to do, not to write a novel, not to write a screenplay, not to write a book? When did you understand, no, it's blogging?
More than coming to see myself as a blogger or a digital journalist, in my case, it was more so out of necessity. The need to narrate my reality. For instance, a question was tormenting me. Where was the Cuba I was promised? Because since I was a child, I was promised a Cuba that has never been realized. So that need to ask and say and really criticize, I knew that I would never fulfill those needs through official forms of media. No one was going to give me a microphone or a minute on the radio or television, and much less a space in the official newspaper. So thanks to the combination of my love of writing, but also my love for technology, I realized I could fuse the two passions of my life, and in 2007, I started a blog. The blog was for me not a decision, but a necessity.
Where did you learn to be so fearless? I mean, literally, do you remember a moment when you faced fear and you just said, I'm going to go for it? And who taught that to you?
Honestly, I think I owe the real drive to my son. I have a 19-year-old son named Theo, and Theo asks many questions. In 2003, when Theo was 8, Cuba experienced what's called La Primavera Negra, or the Black Spring. That moment was hard for all of us because the Cuban government was taking advantage of the war between the United States and Iraq by imprisoning 75 independent journalists and activists. During that moment, a great friend of ours was imprisoned, Adolfo Fernández Sainz, who was an independent journalist. He was close to the family. Theo called him Uncle Adolfo. And so there was a moment where we had to tell Theo that Uncle Adolfo was in prison. And like any other kid, he asked why. Reinaldo, trying to find a positive explanation for a horrible story, said, well, Adolfo is a brave man. And Theo immediately responded, oh, so you guys are cowards because you're free. That's my son. And with a son like that, we can't keep quiet.
No lo puedo creer.
Es tremendo.
What does he dream of? ¿Y él qué sueña? ¿Qué quiere ser?
Lo más interesante es que él pertenece a una generación que ya está viviendo el postcastrismo, ¿no?
The most interesting thing is that he belongs to a generation that is, in a way, already living in a post-Castro world. It is a generation that has developed an interesting mechanism that, I swear, one day science will have to study. His generation has developed selective hearing, and they feel like they're a part of the whole world, and their focus is on the outside. That all around the world, this generation has developed selective hearing, and in general, they love technology. They play video games, they keep up with soccer, they have managed to leave behind the past that my generation is still dragging along. So my dream for him is not only that he develops into a more globally minded person, but also into a person that reaches beyond just this closed bubble of family and friends, a person who can successfully navigate a global society. And I dream that he can live in a normal country, a place where he can scream a phrase on the street corner and where he can have a political opinion without being censored.
What do you say to people in the United States and other places who just feel like they're getting sucked in by technology, that they're becoming less productive because of technology, that they're wasting time because of technology, as opposed to what you see technology, which is this complete liberation?
Sí, bueno, me encantaría que existiera en Cuba también un movimiento así, porque eso significaría que...
I would love it if we had that in Cuba, if there was a movement like that, because it would mean that we've had years and years of internet access. In Cuba's case, we are first trying to make technology a right, while respecting our privacy. Having that ability or possibility to be plugged in 24 hours a day, or have a Twitter account, or simply choose not to use their mobile device. Our situation in Cuba today is far from being like that. Today, it's about getting internet connectivity in our homes, which is nearly impossible. We're still living in a rudimentary state of existence here. We have to solve that problem first.
Can you compare your experience around race and racism in Cuba versus your experience around race and racism, let's say, now in the city of Chicago or in the rest of anywhere else that you might have visited in the United States?
Bueno, tengo que decir que llevo pocos días en Chicago con un programa muy apretado dentro de instituciones, ¿no?
Well, I have only spent a few days in Chicago with a very tight itinerary, but I have seen that this is a very segregated city, and there are places in the city where different sectors of the population, different racial groups, don't really interact. In Cuba, according to the law and institutionally, we don't have racism. That's what we export to the world. Or at least that's what the official media portrays. The truth is that the black population is in a terrible economic situation for many reasons, primarily because emigration has been a white emigration. The people who left Cuba and now send money back to their family, those people are mostly white. You have to understand, in Cuba we have two currencies, the national peso and the convertible currency, which is far more valuable, and the black population feels like they don't get the economic benefit of the convertible currency, which is necessary to live. Whether you have convertible currency or not is the question of the day. If you have it, you get access to stores with more items. It is the difference between using toilet paper or not, drinking milk or not, the difference between eating bread that day or not. There is a huge unofficial institutional prejudice that prevents the black population from rising to decision-making positions, positions of power, administrative positions, jobs with better salaries. The same exists in schools. Even though education is for all and opportunity is for all, it is clear that a 14-year-old black boy has economic imperatives that push him to drop out of school at an early age to start working. More than 90% of people in prison are black. These are official statistics. The majority of the prostitutes in the street are mixed race or black. Economically, they are very marginalized. On the other hand, the official Cuban discourse instills fear in them. They are told that if there is a change, a democratic process in Cuba, you will return to that terrible time before January 1959. They are under the threat of a return to a model that cannot exist anymore because it's in the past. They aren't allowed to associate themselves freely. That is a huge difference between Cuba and Chicago. I see groups of people who fight for equality, integration. In Cuba, all of that is illegal. To talk about it is taboo. Since the official propaganda says it has been eradicated, to speak of it again, you fall into the category of enemy of the state.
Coming up on Latino USA.
I don't know. I really don't want to pick a side. I can't do it. I can't do it. No, but you know, I don't know. You know, may the best team win.
The stress of being a Latino fan during the World Cup. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Oye. Que yo estoy de psiquiatría. ¿Quién te dio? Habla claro. ¿Quién te dio? Oye, viniste a Puerto Rico para decirme que yo estoy.
Él está enfermo mental. Él está enfermo mental. Y hace lo
Dos son cuatro, multiplícalo por seis, sumarle diez, eso llevo de mente por ley. Compadre, la mente enferma es una odienda. Amo el medicamento, el médico sabe a mierda. A mi psiquiatra lo tengo de manicomio sin conocimiento. Se lo estoy metiendo, mongo. Estoy enfermo todos los días como cerdo, aunque se sabe que se sale del infierno.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm María Hinojosa. We're spending this hour looking at what it means to be part of a country. For many Americans, that's meant affordable insurance under the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. California leads the nation in Affordable Care Act enrollment, but there are still millions there who are uninsured. Many of these people are undocumented. They can buy private insurance, but they're specifically excluded from Obamacare. Reporter Lisa Morehouse visits a group trying to fill some of those gaps. Just a note, some people in this story will only be identified by their first names because of their immigration status.
Maria stands behind a table filled with containers of homemade food. There's oatmeal and salsa and fish for tacos.
Arroz y ensalada. Tamales.
She's selling the food to laborers heading out to work for the day, to jobs in agriculture, construction, or hospitality. They're members of Sonoma County's Grayton Day Labor Center, a hiring hub and advocacy and training group. Maria takes pains to cook healthy food, but she doesn't have health insurance herself.
Yo no tengo aseguranza porque soy un roble, no me enfermo, no.
I don't have health insurance because I don't get sick.
Yo no tengo aseguranza porque no me aceptan porque no tengo seguro.
No, I don't have insurance because they won't accept me because I don't have Social Security.
Maria is undocumented. Even though her kids have coverage through a special program, she can't qualify for the state's expanded Medicaid or sign up for insurance on the exchange.
Si hubo Obamacare, a mí no me ayudó en nada.
This new Obamacare hasn't helped my situation at all.
Maria is a single mom. She doesn't make much cleaning houses and selling food. When I ask what would happen if she got really sick, she laughs and holds up a little plastic container.
I'd pass the box around because I couldn't afford it. I wouldn't be able to pay for house expenses, like food, along with the cost of being sick.
She's not alone. At least a quarter of uninsured Californians are expected to be undocumented immigrants. That's up to 1 million people.
And that leaves a population very much vulnerable.
That's Jesus Guzman, an organizer with the Grayton Day Labor Center. He knows this issue personally because some of his uncles are undocumented. He says their diabetes went undiagnosed for too long because they didn't have insurance. For people like them, he says, preventative care makes the most sense.
It being very difficult to access some of these services and resources in the community, what we can do here is serve as a conduit between those organizations and the folks that need them. Being able to provide some of those resources has been really a big push for us.
A physician's assistant from a nearby clinic comes to the center once a week. The staff here offer trainings and heart-healthy practices, and they provide job skill and safety education. And because diabetes is a huge problem among Latinos, nutrition's another big push. Out of the back of a van, Morgan Smith unloads boxes heavy with lettuce, cabbage,
cauliflower, oranges, apples, sweet potatoes.
The Redwood Empire Food Bank brings produce here every month. Smith also distributes special boxes to people diagnosed with type 2 diabetes.
This month the box has things like brown rice, dried black beans, high fiber cereal, a bunch of canned tuna and canned chicken. Everything's healthy carbohydrates, healthy fats, healthy proteins. So it's about 25 pounds of shelf-stable food that will hopefully help someone get through the month a little bit.
Smith is also a registered nurse. He and a colleague set up tables in the Grayton Day Labor Center parking lot and give people free diabetes screenings and prevention information. Maria and her sisters get in line, and she holds out her finger to get blood drawn for a test.
This is your result. Menos de 140 is normal para
Smith tells Maria her results are normal and then lets her know about two clinics near her home if she needs further care. Inside the center, Maria's sister Flor joins other members collecting produce. Like her sister, she's undocumented and uninsured. Flor knows what she'd do if she got insurance tomorrow.
I would go to the doctor, get a checkup, and get all of the tests that need to be done for myself and my entire family.
A while back, her husband was injured in an accident.
And the bill came. Oh my! He had only cut the tip of his finger off, and it cost $10,000.
She says eventually her husband's employer paid the bill, but only because her husband had worked for him for so long. Earlier this year, California State Senator Ricardo Lara proposed a bill that could help people like Maria and Flor. It would give undocumented Californians access to expanded Medicaid and a unique insurance exchange with state subsidies. But a program like that's expensive, and the bill's not expected to pass. Lara's staff says they'll be back with another proposal next year. For Latino USA, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Sonoma County, California.
Lisa Morehouse reported this story for the 2014 California Endowment Health Journalism Fellowship, a program of USC's Annenberg School for Journalism and Communication. When we talk about the soul of the United States, so often we gravitate to the country's middle, places like the Midwest, Texas, the Great Plains. Now, tying all of these places together is a road. It's Interstate 35. It stretches from border to border, from Laredo, Texas, to Duluth, Minnesota. And increasingly, it's part of the circulatory system that brings immigrants from Mexico and beyond into the American heartland. New York Times reporter Damian Cave recently traveled the entire length of I-35 for a multimedia project called The Way North. Through writing, photography, sound, and video, Damian captures the ways immigration is changing the interior of our country. He joins us to speak with us about what he saw along the highway. Welcome back to Latino USA, Damian.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So how has immigration touched the communities that run along this highway?
Well, you know, when we started, what we wanted to do was investigate how immigrants and non-immigrants were getting along or not at the very local level. But the story that I think that hasn't really been told that we found is that for the most part, people are working out their differences. You know, it's not always something they like to do. It's not always working as perfectly as it could. But there's a sense that we heard over and over again of, well, the immigrants are here. We have to work it out.
There were many moments in your series that I really loved. The drive-in in Gainesville, Texas. So, you know, the drive-in movie theater, it's packed with Mexicans.
I have to say, I was just as surprised as anyone would be in that experience. You know, I mean, one of the things that struck me was, you know, a drive-in is kind of this old 1950s idea. And in a lot of ways, Latino culture almost feels like a throwback to the 1950s when you're there at the drive-in, where you have families gathered together. It's sort of this idyllic scene of Americana, and yet it's Latino Americana. And that's really what we saw.
You also saw how Mexican traditions are being transplanted, right? The bautismos, the baptisms, the birthdays, the quinceañeras, the piñatas. You know, I mean, my daughter is 16. I just had her a piñata in her park in Harlem here in New York City. How have you seen these traditions from El Sur, from the South, being adapted into the North?
You know, the cake at this party that we went to in Wichita, Kansas, it didn't say Feliz Cumpleaños, it said Happy Birthday. As somebody who can see both cultures, it's quite apparent that slowly things are changing and that this is a hybrid. You know, the kids on the iPhone are listening to John Legend, you know. A lot of it is sort of generational. I mean, there's a really big difference between parents and children is another thing that we saw.
So what about the resistance to these immigrant communities? Did you get a sense of that as well?
I mean, there's definitely pockets of the country that are still very strongly opposed to illegal immigration and to immigration at all to some degree. But you also have lots of people who are finding ways to accommodate this. You know, I spoke to several kind of retired old ladies at this church who I thought were going to say, oh, you know, the Mexican immigrants are ruining our neighborhood. And, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, they might have said that. But now what they're saying is, listen, it used to be all these guys who came in and just worked and were loud. But now there's families and they're fixing the houses. And they could see the benefits to their community, benefits that maybe weren't as apparent to them 5 or 10 years ago. So as the community changes, as the immigrant community becomes more settled, I think opinions are changing as well.
So after your 38-day trip north on I-35,
What have you decided? Are these immigrants that are coming in actually Americans or not?
You know, I think this is a conversation that the country really needs to have. And the idea here is that, you know, being American is changing. It's something that's in flux. But if you have someone who has spent most of their life here working and has raised a family here, if you asked any of their neighbors, is this person American, I think they would likely say yes.
And after all of your travels, are you feeling confused, hopeful, worried about the future, all of the above?
I would say I'm more hopeful than I was when I started. I mean, at the local level in the middle of the country, Americans are still maintaining that pragmatism that the country's famous for. At the end of the day, they want to get along with their neighbors, and whatever their ideological views might be, that sort of matters most. And I have to say, in some ways, it restored my faith in sort of how the country works. That said, the other thing that's really striking is the divide between how people live at that local level and the conversation in Washington. Washington feels so disconnected from the reality of what's happening in people's communities.
Damian, thanks for your great work.
Thank you.
Damian Cave is a correspondent covering Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean for the New York Times. You can find his multimedia project, The Way North, on the Times website. This week, we're talking about patria. And what better excuse to talk about one's country than the World Cup? Every 4 years, a handful of nations, many of them in Latin America, rally around their national teams as they face off against other countries. Now that the U.S. is out, our producer Camilo Vargas hit the streets of New York City to ask Latinos if they were chanting, Vamos USA.
A handful of American soccer fans chuck their beer and holler at the white screen in a bar in Manhattan. It's the U.S.'s second goal against Portugal. They're white, Hispanic, and some are East Asian. They're covered in U.S. flags, jerseys, and bandanas. And outside the bar, many of the fans said they were also supporting other teams. Ben Ingler, a soccer fan from Minnesota, finds this confusing.
I've run into a lot of people that cheer for a country they were born in, but they've lived here ever since. I don't know. I would cheer for the country I live in, but...
Many of those people are Latinos, especially those from soccer nations in Central and South America. More than a quarter of U.S. Latinos consider soccer their favorite sport. Major League Soccer rallies more Latinos than any other league. And during the World Cup, a lot of them root for their country of origin. I went to Jackson Heights, the heart of the Colombian colony, during a Colombian match. I found Catherine Amante, a soccer mom, and her three children. They were buying Colombian wristbands. She brought the kids for the match.
Who are you rooting for?
I'm rooting for Colombia.
I was born in the U.S. and I grew up in this neighborhood in Jackson Heights. And we live in Staten Island, but we came back home here. This is still home to experience it on a whim.
The Amantes also cheer for the United States at home. A few minutes later, Jackson Heights exploded in cheers and a sea of yellow shirts flooded the streets after Colombia beat Japan. Roberto Arteaga stands quietly as his mom and aunts chant for Colombia on the street. An ecstatic crowd gathers around him as he tells me what it'd be like if Colombia faced the U.S.
I don't know. I really don't want to pick a side. I can't do it. No, but, you know, I don't know. You know, may the best team win.
For the match between the U.S. and Germany, Jackson Heights was not as lively. But I bumped into Wilmer, a Honduran worker wearing the U.S. jersey.
¿Por qué? ¿No le ibas a Honduras antes?
Sí, pero ya lo eliminaron. Entonces vamos a la barra de las estrellas, Estados Unidos.
He's rooting for the Stars and Stripes now that Honduras is out. Then a few blocks down, I walked into one of the dozens of soccer-themed storefronts on Roosevelt Avenue. Salvador Oriucci, the Mexican owner, told me the breakdown of the most popular T-shirts.
De la más, México. Luego vendrá Colombia, Ecuador, Brazil, Estados Unidos.
And when Mr. Oriucci said he was rooting for the U.S. in the match against Germany, his son Carlos interrupted.
Perdón, ¿me puede repetir eso?
Estados Unidos es el equipo de todos.
¿Quiénes son todos?
Pues todos los que vivimos aquí, las comunidades hispanas, anglosajonas, todos los que emigramos acá.
Carlos said the U.S. team was everyone's team. Hispanics, Anglos, all the communities that immigrated here. So as soccer grows in the U.S., maybe all those communities will one day rally around a national team that reflects America's new reality. For now, the U.S. seems to be catching on to the exquisite torture of a good soccer match, like the final few minutes of that dreaded match where Portugal tied the score in the last minute. For Latino USA, I'm Camilo Vargas.
Well, as long as we're playing outdoors, we figured it would be fun to visit with our local bicycle repairman just up the street from us here in Harlem. Edwin Morel owns Talent Cycles, and he happens to be a former racer with the Dominican Republic national team. He's encouraging his neighborhood to hit the roads and trails of New York City, especially now that it's summertime. We meet Edwin Morel just outside his shop in Washington Heights.
Bicycle is a smooth thing. On a race, you can hear a lot more stuff because when you shift, it makes sound.
I was 16 years old when I started cycling in my country, and started with like a really crappy road bike, and people start seeing me like doing good, and you know, starting from there. A normal biking costs you $10,000 on this level, like on professional level, like Tour de France, all this is a lot of money there, so it's, you have to have the money or somebody to support you to doing better in any sport, not just in cycling, any sport. Right here. It's a Cannondale Evo, carbon fiber completely, zip wheel, 4x4x5 crest. The weight is around 14 and a half pounds. Cycling, you have to fight with the wind. So if you're going behind another person, you work less than the person going in front of you because you basically, the guy is covering you for the wind. The wind can stop you in a race, you know, it's a lot of wind, you can have to work hard. Cycling is, it's been really good for my life. It's because of cycling I have this business, because of cycling I have no trouble in my life, you know, like, you know, being in jail or stuff like that, nothing gonna happen. Happening yet, so, you know. I mean, in a sport, if you learn about sport, any sport, you, it's good for life. I mean, you learn a lot of discipline, you learn how to concentrate by one thing, you learn how to be patient, you learn a lot of stuff, you know. But a sport help you to take out you like to work with good people around you, and that's what the life make you good. If you are around good people, you're gonna be good. You know, sometimes you're doing good and you're around bad people and something can happen to you, you know.
Edwin Morel owns Talent Cycles up in Harlem and is a former racer with the Dominican Republic national cycling team. Coming up on Latino USA,
he doesn't even open his office anymore to anybody who happens to be brown. The only way you can get into Kevin McCarthy's office is if you're white.
A legendary activist who still challenges authority. My interview with Dolores Huerta, coming up, no se vayan.
Todos los dolores ya se van. Y el graffiti dice Peter Pan. Zoológico es arco iris, arco iris.
cuando el sol sonríe, sonreirá, no, sonreirá, sonreirá, sonreirá.
Welcome back to Latino USA, and today, my country. Or should I say, our country. At the end of each show on Latino USA, we usually bring you a tidbit of sabiduría, some words of wisdom. But this week, we're making a bit of an exception, as the woman I'm about to introduce has been a role model for Latinas and Latinos for generations now. And she's got wisdom coursing through her blood. From its founding in the United States, this country was set up to be a place where loyal, patriotic descent isn't just tolerated, but it's an American value. That's why I'm so honored to bring our listeners a conversation with labor leader Dolores Huerta, the co-founder of the United Farm Workers with Cesar Chavez. Welcome to Latino USA, Dolores. It's so good to talk with you.
Oh, it's nice to be back.
Dolores, so as I was saying, our country has always valued loyal descent. Your career fighting for the rights of farm workers, helping them to earn living wages, organizing boycotts, being in protests, criticizing, you know, everyone in political power, your life has essentially exemplified that descent. Do you feel that this value has suffered or improved?
Oh, I think if anything, we become a more intolerant country. We don't want people to give their opinions or give their complaints. We recently had an incident because my organization, the Dolores Huerta Foundation, we're working on stopping suspensions and expulsions of our Latino and African-American children, which are a really, really high level. When we spoke to one of our school board members, her reply was, "You make us defensive when you come and you give us your complaints." We see that, I think, with the sort of militarization of our police forces, that if people speak up, then they're somehow punished in some way or the other. So we should always, always question, and we should always have dissent and criticize. If we don't call attention to the wrongs and the things that need to be improved, then nothing changes. The status quo remains, and things never get resolved. First of all, I think when you do criticize, I think that is an act out of love to begin with. It's like when you're a parent, and if your child is doing something that they shouldn't be doing, and you kind of ignore it, then you're not showing love for that child. And I think in the dissent only turns into, say, civil disobedience when people don't listen. But I do believe that all of this is really done out of a spirit of love and a spirit of civility.
Let's talk about Latino leadership organizations. In the mainstream, organizations like the National Council of La Raza, MALDEF, the Mexican Legal Defense and Education Fund, the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute, CHCI. So in your estimation, these large mainstream national Latino leadership organizations, how are they doing in terms of preserving loyal dissent in this country and in their role as spokespeople, if you will, for Latino communities?
Well, I think when it comes to, say, the immigration debate, all of these major organizations that you mentioned have all come to the forefront. But I think that we have to kind of test them somewhat. I was at the NALEO convention that they had recently in San Diego.
And NALEO is the National Association of Latino Elected Officials.
Yes. And I made the statement there that I think all of the national Latino organizations have got to look to their corporate sponsors. And we have to say to the corporate sponsors, we need your help to pass immigration reform. A lot of these organizations, they get a lot of sponsorships from these corporations, but we don't see the corporations really jumping in to help us on immigration reform. We saw that in Arizona when the state legislature passed a bill that would allow public places to discriminate against people who are gay or lesbian or bisexual, et cetera. All of the corporations jumped in. And they said to Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona, don't sign that bill. All of these national organizations have got to step it up, and the corporations have to step it up, because many of them are giving money to these Republican congresspersons for the November elections that are dead set against immigration reform.
Latinos being now the prime consumer market that they all want. Are there corporations that you're prepared to say are not doing enough? And are there some that you're prepared to say are doing great leadership work?
We do know that, say, some of the oil companies, for instance, how many Latinos do we have every day that fill up their car with gasoline from the various gasoline companies? I think that they should be some of our first targets. And when I say that, I mean going to them and to speak to them and to say to them, look, we need your help. People like Chevron, we know Chevron is a contributor to Kevin McCarthy, who is now the new majority leader in the House of Representatives, the Republican majority leader. And so I think we can start with some of the contributors to Kevin McCarthy. We know that in his district, which is in California, in Kern County, over 30% of his district is Latino. There have been many, many petitions. There have been many demonstrations by labor, by religious, by community people, almost on a daily and weekly basis in front of his office, to the point where he doesn't even open his office anymore to anybody who happens to be brown. The only way you can get into Kevin McCarthy's office is if you're white. So, you know, I don't think that this is the way that a congressperson should treat his constituents. And two of them, of his own constituents, were arrested in his office just a couple of weeks ago. So, this is the kind of treatment that our community is getting on the hands of people like this congressperson. Those people that are elected, they can't turn a deaf ear on their constituents and the people that they represent.
I find that interesting, Dolores, and one of the reasons why I really love and enjoy speaking with you, because you always make me think about things in a different way. I would not have immediately thought of, you know, going to the gas companies and saying, think about how many Latino immigrants are using gas in their cars, et cetera, et cetera. I'm wondering about another kind of corporate or major market out there that you're thinking, you know what, no one talks about this major market vis-a-vis Latinos and immigration that you want us to think about.
There's AT&T, there's Walmart. We could probably go on, the major companies. And if we just look at some of the contributors to some of these Republican Congress people, we can see who they are. And I think it's up to us that we have to approach them and say to us, well, this is an American issue. And again, when we celebrate the 4th of July, and we celebrate the founding fathers, and we say, remember, they were immigrants when they came to this country. When we talk about immigration, this is like, you might say, the soul of the United States of America have been the immigrants that have come to this country. And it's interesting, too, when we talk about reflecting on what our country is, then we also have to remember all of the wrongs that the people who settled this country committed, and that some of the discrimination that we still face, it's based on that. It's based on discrimination of people of color. It's based on discrimination against people who are immigrants to this country. So I think it's a good time for us just to reflect who we are as a country. We want to represent ourselves to the rest of the world as a democratic society. But we can't really say that when we have a racial injustice, when we have income inequality. You know, we should be a model for the rest of the world and not be hypocritical when we try to market ourselves as a model, but then when we look internally and see what are we really doing right and what are we really doing wrong in our country. And so it's a reflection. It's a time to reflect and say, I remember someone saying that our country is really a promise. It's an idea that really hasn't been entirely fulfilled. And when we think, well, who's going to make that happen when only we, the people, the citizens, the residents of this country, we are the only ones that can bring that fulfillment to fruition, to really say that, yes, we do have a real democracy where people here share the resources of the country, and we don't have like the 1% that control all of the wealth while the 99% doesn't.
You did, in fact, create Si Se Puede, which became the theme of the United Farm Workers. Of course, then President Barack Obama used Si Se Puede, Yes We Can, in both of his campaigns. This is what he had to say about you in that.
And on a personal note, Dolores was very gracious when I told her I had stolen her slogan, Si Se Puede, Yes We Can. Knowing her, I'm pleased that she let me off easy, because Dolores does not play.
So what does it mean to you that yes, Barack Obama used your slogans for his presidential campaigns?
First of all, I thought it was just great to be able to get the Medal of Freedom for President Obama, because in my mind, it was the recognition of how important organizing is. And Si Se Puede is such an empowering slogan, because it means that we as individuals, we can make things happen. For the president to use that slogan and then for it to be identified, you know, with progressive causes. And it sort of came out of the universe, right? We were in Arizona back in 1972, and they had passed a law to make it illegal for farm workers to go on strike or to say boycott anything. And if anybody went on strike or said boycott, they could go to jail for saying those slogans. And so Caesar started a fast, which he did another 25-day fast. It was the second fast. And as I was inviting some of our professional Latinos in Phoenix, Arizona, to come and join us, their response was, oh, in California, you can do all of those things, but in Arizona, you can't. In Arizona, no se puede. My response to them was, sí se puede, sí se puede in Arizona. That evening when I went back to our group and I gave the report and I told them what they had said, no se puede, and I said, sí se puede, and everybody jumped up and they started clapping in unison, sí se puede, sí se puede. And then, you know, looking at the World Cup games and you see the Latino countries that are they're rooting for their teams, and what are they saying? Sí se puede. So it's wonderful that very simple slogan then has come now a universal chant when people want good things to happen.
So what's going on for you right now, Dolores, as this is the president who has deported more people than ever before, 2 million now. We have a crisis with children, child refugees from Central America, how they're being held in our country. How do you process this crisis and lack of movement in immigration reform at this particular time in our country?
Well, it's complex, but number one, first, we have to put the blame for not passing the immigration reform bill right smack at the feet of Boehner, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and Kevin McCarthy, because they will not bring the bill to a vote. If they would bring the bill to a vote, H.R. 15, I'm sure that it will pass, because we know that over 75% of the American public wants immigration reform. Over 60% of the Republican Party wants immigration reform. It would pass. In terms of the children that are coming in mostly from Central America, I think that these are economic refugees and political refugees and people that are escaping violence and poverty in their country. I think we in the United States, we have a responsibility. If we remember when we had the wars in Central America, wouldn't it be great if we could equate the amount of money that we spent in wars in El Salvador, in Nicaragua, in Honduras, right? And say, we owe these countries this money to help them develop their infrastructure, to help them fight the violence. And when we talk about people escaping violence because of the drug wars, hey, American citizens, stop using drugs, all right? Stop using the drugs. Let's boycott drugs. And that way, in terms of the deportations, I think, and I can't speak for the president, but I think that he feels that he's bound by the legislation that's been passed in the past. And I think he thought that he could get the Republicans on his side if he went along with securing the border. The other thing I want to remind people that it's been over a year ago that the president made a pronouncement where he said that they should not deport any students. They should not deport parents of citizen children, and that they should not deport anyone unless they had a strong criminal record. But the INS, or the Homeland Security, as it's now known, I guess they do whatever they want. Even here in California, we had Governor Jerry Brown in the legislature pass what they call the Trust Act, so that they would not be, again, deporting people using those guidelines that the president put out there. But they pretty much are doing what they please, you know.
Finally, Dolores, every one of our shows on Latino USA, we end with a little bit of sabiduría, some words of wisdom. So do you have some favorite words of wisdom, Dolores, that you come to? Is there something, some sabiduría that you carry with you that you'd love to pass on to the listeners of Latino USA?
Well, a lot of people ask me, gosh, you're 84 years old and you still have all this energy and you're still working. I'm going to pass this on. I think it's because I do not eat meat. I'm a vegetarian, although I do eat fish. I guess that means we're a pescatarian. So I just want to say to everybody out there, just be careful of what you eat, what you put in your body. And the other thing that I've just been recently realizing that I'm able to walk pretty good. I just did a 7-mile march with the young people who did the March for Democracy that I mentioned earlier. This is the 99 Rise group that is calling attention to the money in politics. And I realized something, that I could walk those 7 miles because I do a lot of dancing. And I'm sure people, when they see me on Twitter or Facebook, they, oh, there she is dancing again. So any opportunity that I can to walk or to dance, because I think if we start young, all listeners out there, especially, you make your legs strong. And if you make your legs strong, when you're 84 like me, you can still dance.
I love that, Dolores Huerta. Thank you so much for those words of wisdom. I think I got to go out and start dancing, and I promise I'm going to stop eating as much red meat as I do, which is not a lot.
That's good.
But I'm going to do that for you, Dolores. Dolores Huerta, thank you so much for your words of wisdom and for everything that you've done for our country. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Maria, for all the wisdom that you bring to all of us through your program. Que bueno, que bueno. I can't think of a better person to represent our country and the freedoms, and especially the freedom of the press and freedom of expression, than you, Mariana Josa. You are a blessing for our community. Gracias.
Ay, me vas a hacer llorar, Dolores. Have a beautiful weekend, mamita. Muchos saludos a tu familia, okay?
Thank you. Muchas gracias.
Gracias, Dolores. Muchos abrazos. Queridos listeners, that's it for today. Latino USA is produced by A.C. Valdez, Katie Davis, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Julia Alsop, Sarah Barrett, Sara Rocha, Brenda Rodriguez, and Roxanne Scott. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks to Valley Public Radio and Don Weaver. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, we'll see you on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And I'll see you on my Instagram, Maria_la_Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Funding for Latino USA's coverage of a culture of health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Funding for our series Radio Nature is provided by the REI Foundation, supporting today's youth to develop a lifetime commitment to nature and the outdoors. Latino USA's tech coverage is supported by the Kaper Center for Social Impact, which leverages technology for positive, progressive change. Tech for good, good for tech. KaperCenter.org. And the California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians.
No matter the size, all these guys have one thing in common, and that is that they have beautiful legs.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.